Well, AM is made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, welcoming musical artists Edgar Meyer and Chris Thile, and the ensembles Creole Stomp and Camarada Sweden in the new year. For more information, contact the Krannert Center ticket office at 217-333-6280 or visit krannertcenter.com. Support for today's broadcast is provided by World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods at 6th and University in Champaign. For over 14 years, providing Champaign-Urbana with an international selection of cheeses, olive oil, balsamic vinegar, spices, chocolates, cookies, and more. Catering services are also available. World Harvest encourages you to join them in supporting public radio.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. This afternoon, we're going to take a look at the coming challenges posed by America's fiscal problems and the aging of America. Syndicated finance columnist Scott Burns is our guest. He is co-author with Lawrence Kotlikoff of the new book, The Coming Generational Storm, What You Need to Know About America's Economic Future. Lawrence Kotlikoff is professor of economics at Boston University and a research associate at the National Bureau of Economic Research. Our guest this afternoon, co-author Scott Burns, writes for the Dallas Morning News. His syndicated column appears in newspapers across the country, including the News Gazette. You'll also find him online at www.scottburns.com and on MSN's Money Central website. He is one of the most widely read financial writers in the country. Let me share with you now an excerpt from the book jacket for The Coming Generational Storm. In 2030, as 77 million baby boomers hobble into old age, walkers will outnumber strollers. There will be twice as many retirees as there are today, but only 18% more workers. How will America handle this demographic overload? How will Social Security and Medicare function with fewer working taxpayers to support these programs? According to the authors, if our government continues on the course it has set, we'll see skyrocketing tax rates, drastically lower retirement and health benefits, high inflation, a rapidly depreciating dollar, unemployment, and political instability. The government has lost its compass, say Kotlikoff and Burns, and the current administration is heading straight into the coming generational storm. That's an excerpt from the book jacket for The Coming Generational Storm. Now, that paragraph is followed by this sentence, this advice: don't panic. So this afternoon, be prepared to hear some alarming information, but don't panic. Scott Burns has some ideas about what policymakers need to do to turn things around. He also has some ideas for what we as individuals can do to ensure our financial well-being through retirement. Listeners, your questions and comments are invited. You can join the discussion with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Scott Burns, good afternoon. Welcome. Thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Hi, Celeste. Good to have the opportunity to talk about this issue.
Yeah. Well, I had to keep saying to myself over and over and over again, don't panic, as I was making my way through the book. And one of the interesting things is, in a sense, we should all be aware of this. You know, one of the questions I have for you at the outset here is, you know, it seems to me that our policymakers, they're not really in the dark. Maybe they are in the dark a little bit, but mostly it seems that we're in denial. What do you think?
Well, we are in denial, and we've hired politicians to be in denial for us. We don't want to deal with the issue. And we also have this kind of legacy accounting that doesn't tell us anything. You know, for instance, we had, remember those purported years where we were operating in a surplus?
Mm-hmm.
How do you explain then that the gross debt of the United States increased in each one of those years? It's because of the way our government accounts for its spending. And, you know, we have an archaic system. We operate on a cash basis, like we were a Kool-Aid stand. And the United States government isn't a Kool-Aid stand. It was an adequate tool for saying what the government was doing until the United States government became an insurance company, which it did when it when the Social Security bill was passed in 1935. What would you think of a life insurance company that accepted your premiums and promised you future benefits if that insurance company declared a profit every year based on just what, the money that came in this year versus the money that went out? You know, mm-hmm. They wouldn't be putting any money aside for future claims. Well, our government has never done that. And that's what Kotlikoff's generational accounting is all about. It's about taking into account what the future promises are. And when you do that, you come up with really deeply scary numbers.
Yeah, yeah. Well, for some time now, we've heard about how we're changing demographically, the number of retirees growing, and the boomers leaving the workforce, and the boom in the boomers leaving is coming along pretty quickly. When do you expect the number of retired persons to outnumber those in the workforce?
I don't think they ever outnumber the people in the workforce, but I think we go down to a ratio of about 2-to-1 somewhere around mid-century. And that's way down from where it was in the 40s and 50s. And basically, we've gotten hit with a double whammy. We had a bulge in population in the 50s. That's when we had the highest birth rate in say, a half century. Since then, the number of births per woman has declined dramatically, so that we're now just below replacement rate, whereas it was nearly twice that when it peaked in 1957, I think it was. And so we're getting this surge of people who've retired being met by a declining number of babies growing up and joining the workforce. You know, so this is not a thing of government evil. It's the result of the very best intentions and changes in human reproduction.
But it has great implications for the insurance business that the government is in, Social Security and Medicare.
Absolutely, because the mechanism for supporting retirees is based on the number of Americans who are working, you know, the what's called the compact between generations. The compact between generations works if we have a constant increase in the number of people working and a comfortable ratio between the people working and the number of people retired. But we've made the problem worse our government continues to make promises of future benefits without any changes in the money being put aside to provide those benefits. And that's where there's a major problem. Let's put it in some terms that almost everybody listening is going to have experienced. Not quite, a little over 20 years ago, a then obscure economist chaired a commission to save Social Security, because in 1983 Social Security was in trouble. The trust fund was nearly broke. There were rising number of retirees, and something had to be done. So the commission came up with a plan. The plan made Social Security secure and viable for at least 75 years. What they did was they changed the age of full retirement benefits from 65 and started moving it ahead so that if you were born in 1939 or later, you have to retire a little after age 65. They also put a tax on Social Security benefits. It was a non-event at the time because of the income at which it started. But it is one of the two pieces of the tax code that isn't indexed to inflation. The other piece, by the way, is the alternative minimum income tax, which is also biting people. So now we have a tax on benefits that's growing, reduced benefits unless you retire later, and of course the employment tax was increased a bit. The obscure economist who ran that commission is a fellow named Alan Greenspan. Only 20 years later, he is testifying in Congress that the situation is out of hand again and that we have to warn future retirees that their benefits will have to be reduced. 20 years later. The major impact for that, the cause of that, is demography and advancing life expectancies. So, part of this is good news. We could cure the entire problem if we should just get enough people to volunteer to die young.
That's not going to happen.
No, it ain't going to happen.
Yeah.
I've called for volunteers, giving speeches, and curiously, not a single person has ever raised their hand.
Yeah, I would imagine people would be stepping backward,
right,
not forward, on that deal. Well, what is Mr. Greenspan saying now about what is needed? And maybe you would talk with us about some of the things that you think that you and Mr. Kotlikoff think could turn the story around in terms of Social Security.
But his recommendation is first to give advance warning so that people can be prepared that the benefits aren't going to be what they expected to have. Unfortunately, he's not saying that the employment tax should be reduced. So basically, going forward, people are going to get a worse and worse deal out of Social Security, the retirement program. He is suggesting that one way to reduce the problem significantly is to decouple the growth of benefits from productivity by changing the index that is part of calculating the benefits. And that sounds innocent enough, except that the net effect is going to be that the portion of income that is replaced by Social Security benefits will go down across the board. And that's not a minor deal. Two-thirds of all retirees get 50% or more of their cash income from Social Security. So mm-hmm. when you start talking about we're going to reduce the benefits, you're talking about a real run on cat food at the supermarket.
Yeah, well, this is why Social Security is referred to as the third rail in politics. It's difficult to touch.
Yes, and you had a politician in your state quite a few years ago who was actually attacked when he talked about doing the Medicare Catastrophic Health Care Act.
And who was that?
I'm trying to think of his name at the moment. He was actually surrounded by Social Security recipients.
Dan Rostenkowski.
Rostenkowski.
Yes.
Exactly.
Oh yes, he faced a mob. Well, you mentioned a moment ago one of the things that, if I'm recalling correctly what you just said, is Alan Greenspan is not talking about reducing the employment tax.
No, he's talking about... go ahead.
He's not talking about reducing the employment tax, but you are, right?
We're talking about starting over and basically issuing new possibilities and new promises. Instead of partially privatizing Social Security, privatize it entirely. Now, before your listeners on Social Security get alarmed, here's how it would be done. Everyone who has accrued benefits to date would be guaranteed those benefits. The benefits would be paid by a national sales tax. A national sales tax would broaden the base for paying those benefits. It would be, in one stroke, a very good move in that it would actually tax wealth somewhat, because anybody who spends their wealth would have to pay that sales tax. Right now, we have a very regressive tax as the base for supporting retirees, the employment tax. You know, you earn $6 an hour, you pay the employment tax. You earn over $89,000, $90,000 next year, and you don't pay the employment tax. So it's a very regressive tax. It's a high tax. It's been the fastest growing tax in my adult life. And for all the BS over the income tax, neither party has the guts to look at that. So we replace the employment tax with a sales tax. Everyone who's retired or about to retire will receive the same benefits, but they will be funded through a different source. Younger people, instead of facing a future of an increasing employment tax providing less and less in benefits, which is what they are looking at, will have a private savings plan. Now, the first, you know, scream that comes out about this is, what about risk, et cetera? Mm-hmm. You can put in government guarantees against loss. But you can also make sure that it is inexpensive to run and not just a free-for-all for the mutual fund and insurance industries. The federal government has FERS, the Federal Employee Retirement Savings Plan. It operates on a basis far less expensive than the average 401k plan, and basically uses index funds. ExxonMobil has a 401k plan that's run on the same basis that has a cost of less than 0.1% per year to manage. So this can be done inexpensively. It can be done efficiently. You know, if Exxon has the bargaining power to do it, trust me, the federal government will have the bargaining power to get this done. And then younger people can look forward to actually accumulating real assets, and we can eliminate a lot of the inequities that were built into the Ozzie and Harriet conception of the world that prevailed when Social Security was created. You know, the increase in benefits that many people have experienced over the last 20 to 30 years has been funded almost entirely by the increased participation of women in the labor force. You know, when you go back, you look at where the benefits come from. In a household of two, the primary earner pays the employment tax, and the spouse also gets benefits in the amount of one half while paying nothing. The consequence has been that, you know, since World War II, basically since the start of the program, women have been supporting with their labor. They've been paying that tax and getting virtually no increase in benefits for that tax. And Social Security is filled with inequities that just happen to do with the way it was formulated. Let's put it on a basis. You save money, you get a return, you will have options for what to do with the money when you retire.
Our guest this afternoon is syndicated finance columnist Scott Burns, co-author with Lawrence Kotlikoff of The Coming Generational Storm, What You Need to Know About America's Economic Future. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name's Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us with a telephone call, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, anywhere else toll-free, 800-222-9455. We have some callers waiting to talk with you, Mr. Burns. Let's go first to a listener in Champaign County on line one. Hi.
Hi. Quite a few things to unravel here. I was prompted to call when you talked about Greenspan delinking benefits with productivity. I've always heard it as with payroll instead of a cost of living adjustment, but I've always thought that we should link to productivity. I mean, one can look at the scary figures of how few less workers there are working, but productivity gains have compounded over the years, and I think it's important to say part of that should be plowed back into Social Security. It shouldn't all just go to stock investors. And the solution is not simply, I don't oppose people investing, et cetera, but I think a portion of productivity gains, and this translates into a corporate or a value-added tax of some kind, should be put into the Social Security system. It would be a more progressive way to do it. As far as you're saying that a sales tax is like a wealth tax, I mean, that's that's a stretch. A wealth tax is a wealth tax. A tax on consumption is always regressive because people at higher income levels always spend less of their income. So basing it on that, why don't you just call for the Social Security tax to be made progressive instead?
It's already progressive.
No, it isn't.
You're not correct, sir.
FICA has
you're not
a,
correct.
Has
if
a
you
top
look at
end,
the benefits, Social Security is highly progressive because while there are bend points in the calculation of your benefits, while everyone pays the same tax on their labor, they don't get a proportionate benefit back. If you earn under $20,000 a year, you get far more of your wages back in benefits than somebody who earns $60,000 a year. Basically, you go from over 50% of replacement to about 24% at the top end of the income scale. So there's a very steep invisible tax in the formulation of the benefit calculation.
But it is regressive in the sense that it doesn't go up with income. It goes up to a certain level and then it doesn't get collected on the rest of the margin.
Exactly so.
That's my definition of regressive. I mean, instead of saying that...
Did you hear me say it wasn't regressive? I said it was the fastest growing and most regressive tax in America. And one of the reasons it should be replaced with a broader tax, which is a national sales tax, is that that is massively broader. It would encompass not only all spending, and you may believe that it isn't a tax on wealth, but in fact, any time you spend money, if it isn't from income, it's going to be from wealth, and everyone is aware that there are some people who spend their wealth.
But it's regressive in the sense that at the lower end, the people at the lower income level would be paying proportionally more. I mean, isn't that the definition of regressive? I mean,
it's a relative issue. If the only thing that's taxed is labor and there is a cap on the tax on labor, that's highly regressive. If you tax a broader range, which is all sources of spending, whether it is low income, high income, or capital being spent, then you have a much broader tax. And you also likely have the possibility that wealthy people will pay a great deal more of it. Right now, wealthy people don't contribute very much to the entire issue because the tax is capped at $90,000 for 2005.
I want to thank the listener for his call. I've got a number of other folks waiting to talk with our guest this afternoon. Could there be a situation where we could have this national sales tax, but some things would be exempted? For example, certain food items or over-the-counter medication, that kind of thing.
It's open to discussion. Yeah. You could exempt food. We have, you know, different kinds of sales taxes throughout the country.
Mm-hmm.
The more you exempt, the higher the tax has to be. That's the only issue.
Yeah. Let's talk with another caller. Next, we're going to go to a listener on the toll-free line, a listener in San Francisco, California. Good afternoon.
Yes, how are you? At the risk of sounding radical, I would say that I would sure hate to be rich in these times. It looks like there's going to have to be a French Revolution with some of these scams that are going passing as reality to declare that that whole discussion was that Social Security is this progressive issue. It's just frightening to imagine that the education system has been ruined for the last few decades by these same Republicans who claim that once the Civil Rights Act happened and they started collapsing the education system rather than integrating it, we've ended up in a horrible situation. But I'm interested in Pete Peterson, who is, I believe, was that Ronald Reagan or Nixon's Secretary of the Treasury? He's been out here pushing a scam also, similarly, that Social Security, oh, God, what is he wanting to do? He wants to cut off future gains, the cost of living to the future generations. So in other words, you know, currently we've got seniors getting a pittance, you know, maybe $400, $600 a month, and they're supposed to live on that. And if inflation increases, as it will, I mean, obviously, the way Bush is ruining the economy, we're going to end up having to have wheelbarrows full of money in order to buy a postage stamp. And
do you have
so
a question? That,
with those kind of numbers, we're going to then tell the future generations that they're going to have to take an equal pittance, and it's going to be based upon fake numbers, just like before. Here's this guy, so-called expert, telling us that we don't get our money, and that that he's too much of an expert, and that we just have to swallow whatever garbage he gets to push. And Pete Peterson is out there also pushing some fake numbers and telling us that we don't get a future, and that these people are obviously perfect, and their master race is always right, and that we have to suffer.
Can I interrupt
here?
Yeah,
let's give our guest a chance to respond now.
There is blame for both parties. We have massive irresponsibility at all levels of government and from both parties. You cannot blame this on George Bush. Social Security is an issue that has been growing for not years, not administrations, but for decades. So just, if you, listener, are going to be able to develop any capacity to think about this issue, you have to stop demonizing and start looking at the broad historical flow of numbers. This is not about being a Democrat. This is not about being a Republican. This is about demography and reproduction and making promises. Both parties are addicted to making promises that cannot be fulfilled. That's why we have the issue. The unfunded liabilities of the United States government are now, after the prescription drug benefit passed, over $50 trillion. If you look at the Federal Reserve statement of the balance sheet of the U.S. public, including college endowments and nonprofit institutions, at the end of 2003, it was $43-odd trillion. In other words, the obligations, if we took every bit of wealth possessed by every American, including every dime that Bill Gates has, if we took the endowment of Harvard, if we took the endowment of Yale, if we closed down Skull and Bones, we would not have enough money to fulfill the promises that have been made by our government. these promises have been made by members of both parties, Democrats and Republicans. We need another party. We don't, you know, our politicians are irrelevant. And we need to start thinking about this as an actual problem. What are the promises that have been made, and how are they going to be fulfilled?
Hmm. In the book, The Coming Generational Storm, one of the things that you point out is how politicians of both parties have buried this information, have played a shell game with us. And I'm wondering, what's your opinion of our news media here in terms of laying out what kind of situation we're in and some of the options that we might have?
We're part of the problem. There is a preemptive status that government press releases and statistical releases have. We generally present them without questioning them. So when there is a statement that the U.S. government operated at a surplus, the press corps in general doesn't question it and can't question it. The same standard that the press would bring toward a statement made by a business executive or a foreign power, where they would look for balance and say, but so-and-so says otherwise, is not applied to any statement from the United States government. I first became aware of this back in the 70s when we had an energy czar named Schlesinger. There were almost weekly press conferences in which he would make statements about future energy prices. Note the word future, the unknown. And they were printed without any caveats throughout the press in the United States. We need to disbelieve our government. We need to hold our politicians of both ilks to be responsible for better reporting of what our government is doing.
Hmm. Let's talk with another listener, caller in Wellington, line two.
Hi. Yes, I just am concluding an Eastern Illinois University class that's kind of touched on the changing job scene and immigration and how it's affecting the job markets and how the changing demographics are going to change Social Security, which has been very enlightening. And during my research, I came across some of the work of Gohel and Smetters. And while I understand the Social Security Administration has not embraced their figures, they have embraced their accounting methods, which is kind of a de facto embrasure, I guess. And some of those figures of what would happen to slashes in benefits and even more to increases in taxes are really pretty frightening.
Yes, they are.
But anyway, my take on it is that, you know, we pay on Medicare. Every dollar you make income on Medicare is taxed. And I think that that's what should happen with Social Security, too. I think that that would help it out. And then cap the level at which there's paybacks, you know, $100,000 or something like that, or $200,000. There is no reason that people that make $1 million or $500,000 or whatever are not going to be able to live on their, because they undoubtedly have investments, besides whatever that amount that they would be getting back from the government would be. And that would help to take care of the people on the bottom end of the scale that are scraping by on $1,000 or less a year without any major tax increases, broad-based as a sales tax. And the reason I'm kind of opposed to sales tax is you see it in Europe, they have VAT taxes everywhere. And they're running into the very same problems. The only thing that's kind of keeping this whole thing afloat in both the industrialized nations and in the U.S. is immigrants coming in. They're kind of buoying up the worker base. But then, too, you also have those people working at lower levels so that they're not able to contribute at a higher level as some of the people are going to be starting to draw down from it have in the past. So you see in Europe, because they're paying these high VAT taxes, they still have high unemployment due to some of that. stagnating economies and that high inflation you're talking about. And all those things tend to lead to a certain measure of political unrest, and they too, because they have even increased welfare systems over the ones in this country, are having to scale back their benefits, what have you, et cetera. And so I just think that that would be probably the most logical way of dealing with that.
What do you think of the caller's proposal?
First, I want to congratulate her for being very well informed. She's done a lot of homework. I wish more people would take the time to do the homework so that they could have a better grasp of the issues. She is not alone in thinking, well, let's just tax all wages instead of capping it at the $90,000 it will be next year. And I wrote a column earlier in the year examining that, and in fact, in terms of the Social Security retirement program, if you did that, you would cover virtually all of the unfunded liabilities. So that's a possibility. It certainly would be popular. There are a lot more people who earn less than $90,000 than there are people who earn over $90,000. There is one limitation to it, which is that about 85% of the unfunded liability problem is not in Social Security, the retirement program. It's in Medicare alone. So, for instance, last year, the Medicare prescription drug bill, the liabilities attached to that bill alone are as great as the unfunded liabilities of Social Security, the retirement program. That's what I mean about an irresponsible government, whether you're talking about Democrats or Republicans. That was passed by a Republican administration. It's being called for by people who vote, who are older, and so the politicians, they say, sure, we'll make the promise, but we have no idea where the money's going to come from.
Mm. So we still have, if we remove the cap that's currently at $90,000, we still have a Medicare problem.
Yes.
Okay. And your proposal that we talked about earlier, the national sales tax to broaden the tax base and private savings plans, would that plan then also take care of our situation with Medicare?
No.
So that's another issue.
That's another issue, and Kolakoff might disagree with me, but I think it's largely it's an intractable problem that we need to have a significant revolution in medical care because we are not in a position to fulfill the promises that have been made. We've basically given everybody a blank checkbook, yet. We're a society at war with itself. We don't require that anybody take care of themselves, whether it's by drinking less, smoking less, eating less, exercising more, and then we have all the medical liabilities that grow out of that. You've seen probably the reports on just the estimates of the liabilities, future liabilities to be traced to diabetes are enormous.
Let's talk with another listener. Caller in DeKalb County on line one. Hi.
Good afternoon. Now, what happened when we had luxury tax on luxuries? They said there was a reduction in luxuries, purchases, did they not? So they took luxury tax off. What happens when they talk about more taxes on income? They say there's less people would be inclined to work. Now, when you tax consumer items, some have projected maybe 20% tax on an automobile. A young person would have to go out and borrow money on a $20,000 automobile to pay the $4,000 tax. The man with money can pay income tax without paying interest on the money. I talked to Senator Lucas proposed that type of tax, and I talked to a car dealer 3 years ago. I said they propose a consumer tax. He says that we already have one in Illinois. Well, I said Senator Lucas and others are proposing, and they send around for contributions to change the tax code. They say it'll be simpler. Well, this man said it'll never happen. Well, I said when people come in and buy, the dealer said, like the foreign people, they'll say, immigrants, how much is the entire amount going to cost, the tax and the automobile? So I said this will bring used cars up and new cars down because they will not have the money to buy the new car. Well, he says, buy one now. I says, I'll wait till they come down, and he hung up. So that's the feeling that a consumer tax wouldn't work very well in our system. We already have it, and as they say, it will tax the person that doesn't have the money. I miss an old neighbor when he was talking. He says income tax. I like income tax because I know when I pay tax, I'm making money. I haven't heard that or seen that written for 2 years, and I miss such a person. Not that any of us like to pay tax, but another thing, if the people put the money in stock, you can't pick up the paper without. Recently, it was global, and the books were cooked, according to the paper. So in the government, you say their employees, they have a program. Well, then why don't the government just invest instead of the people invest? And another question, when you have a pension or you have insurance, you don't pay tax until the amount you receive, like insurance. The amount you have put in is tax-free in return, but after you get, like I'll say, new money, that's taxable. If people pay on their pensions, that's tax-free thereafter.
I'm going to interrupt you there because we're running down on time, and I want to give Scott Burns a chance to respond to some of the ideas that you put on the table this afternoon.
I think all those points were interesting, and it shows that this is a very large, intractable problem. It doesn't have an easy fix. It doesn't have a comfortable fix. Gawkla Smetters figures all showed that in order to cope just with the Social Security portion, we would have to have a very large increase in either the employment tax or the income tax, or we'd have to have a large immediate reduction in benefits. So let's just accept at the outset, and this is why we can't be politically divided about this. We have a lot of people who are aging. They're not going to stop aging. And we need to be more creative than thinking about applying heavy pillows to their faces. Whatever tax you pick will not be popular. The only tax that is popular is a tax that is paid by someone else. The only tax that is just is a tax that is paid by someone else. You know, I'm sorry, I've been writing for newspapers for 30 years, and that's just the way it works. So I think we have a variety of things that we can do. On Social Security, the retirement program, we need to free our children and our grandchildren from the coupling of childbirth and taxation. and benefits. We need to allow them to save real money. Period. In the area of Medicare, I think we need a revolution in self-care and public consciousness. And we might change some of the liabilities that are coming toward us.
Yeah. We have to wrap up here. Before we go, though, I want to talk about, you mentioned sort of something that's very simple and so obvious, which amounts to eat an apple every day, take care of yourself. But also, in our personal lives, this is something that you and Mr. Kotlikoff talk about in the book, downsize, pay off debt, save more, postpone your retirement, own your own home, anticipate higher taxes. Of these, you want to pick one and maybe just talk with us very briefly about it because we've got to wrap up.
Home ownership is important because it is one of the few tax benefit investments where you get both a consumption benefit and an investment benefit. It also allows people a lot of flexibility. For instance, a great many people accumulate little in financial assets, but if they can just pay off a house, they have that asset that doesn't require income. They also have the possibility of selling the house and scaling down. Earlier this year, I did a road trip from Florida to California visiting RV parks and resort communities across the Southwest. You can move to a very lovely RV park called Buena Vista in Mesa, Arizona. You can buy a 1,000-square-foot house there for $50,000, pay land rent of about $400 a month. That means that anybody in the Northeast who has owned a home for 5 or 10 years can move and have a dramatic impact on the largest single budget element in most people's spending, shelter.
That was very interesting. I remember that column, and I also remember the column you wrote recently about what we could save if we downsized the automobile that we were driving. Very interesting. And I'm just going to sum up here by letting our listeners know that if they want to read your past columns and they have access to the Internet, they can look at your past columns at www.scottburns.com. And the book Scott Burns has written with Lawrence Kotlikoff is The Coming Generational Storm, What You Need to Know About America's Economic Future. Scott Burns, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's my pleasure.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. It's 6 minutes before 2 o'clock. Settlement prices should be in from the Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thanks much, Celeste. Hey, Celeste, I read that Scott Burns column on the automobile, too, and that really was quite something. He's quite a writer, so if you get a chance, go hit his website. It'll be worthwhile looking up. Now, something else worthwhile for all the farmers out there who are interested in the numbers from the Chicago Board of Trade this afternoon. Here they are. The bean pit was lower today. That despite two more confirmations from USDA and APHIS that soybean rust is now in South Carolina and Tennessee officially. I believe we had talked about Tennessee maybe last week at some point, but it's official now. Soybean rust has spread to South Carolina and Tennessee, and I think that brings the total number of states to 9 here in the United States where soybean rust has been found. Despite all of that, the bean futures were lower. That was technically driven. We'll talk to Paul Cooley about that later this afternoon at 6 after this next hour at 2 o'clock Central Time. Stay with us for that. Paul and Dave Dickey, of course, up in DeKalb at the Sycamore, in Sycamore, frankly, at the very, very nice Farm Bureau building there. Thanks to all the folks who made it out to see them last night. Kind of rough weather conditions, Dave said, and there were several, there were several dozen folks that made it out last night to that program, and we sure do thank you for making it to the program. So let's take a look at the numbers from the Board of Trade at this hour. Wheat futures, December contract, 286. The settlement price down 3.75 with a high of 93 and a low of 85. March contract, 303.75, the high, the low at 96.25. Settled 297.5, down 3.75. The May futures, 310.25, high, low at 303.25. Settled 303.75, off 3.5. July futures, 317, the high, the low at 10. Settled at 310.25, down 3.5. And September contract, off 2.5 at 317.5 for the day. December corn, 194.25, the high, the low at 191.25. Settlement price at 191.5. They were off 1. The March futures down 0.5 cent, 203.25, the settlement price with a high of 5.75 and a low at 203. And the May corn, 213.5 high, low at 210.75, settled 211. They were off 0.25 cent. July futures, 220.75, the high, the low at 18.25, settled 0.25 above that at 18.5, down 0.75 cents. September, 226.5, they were off 1 with a high of 28.5, a low at 26.5. And next year's Dees contract, a 38.25 high, low at 236.5, settlement price on that low down 1 cent. Dees oats at 3/4 higher at 168.75 for the day. From the soy complex now, nearby Jan beans, 538.5, the high, the low at 527, settled at 28 even, down 6.75, the March off 4.5 cents with a high of 40.5, 31 the low, the settlement price at $5.31.5. Once again, that March contract down 4.5 cents for the day. May futures, 547.5 high, low at 538, settled 38.75, down 4.75. And to July futures, a 546 settlement price down 4.75 with a 54.5 high and a 45 low. August beans, 555, the high, the low at 549, settled on that low down 4.5 cents. And next year's November, we're off 4 at 560.75, the high at 69.5, the low at 560 even. Dees bean meal, a 156.70 high, low at 153.10, settled 153.60, down 60. The January contract, 154.90, off 70. December bean oil, 20.62, the high, the low at 20.30, settled 24, down 22, and the Jans down 24 at 20.46. Here's Celeste with the numbers from the Merck.
Okay, Todd, thank you. It was a lower day today for livestock prices. January feeder cattle, 104.40, the high, 103.25, the low, 103.27.5, the settlement, that down 67.5. March, $100.10, the high, 98.35, the low, 98.42.5, the settlement, that down 145. April, 98.50, the high, 96.80, the low, 96.80, the settlement, that down 160. December live cattle, 90.20, the high, 89.02.5, the low, the settlement, 89.17.5, that down 115. February, 89.70, the high, 88.55, the low, 88.87.5, the settlement, that down 67.5. December lean hog, 79.92.5, the high, 78.62.5, the low, 78.95, the settlement, that down 12.5. February, 77.72.5, the high, 75.67.5, the low.